The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with a cultural comment from the December 24th, 2023 issue of the New Yorker magazine. The Real Gift of the Magi. What all the mythology and history of the Magi suggest is that no bright lines exist to separate fakery from faith. By Adam Gopnik. The Welcome Winter Festival has been upon us, starting with the solstice of the sun and carrying on until those late arriving gift givers, the Magi, finally show up, as they will, in all their many shapes and stylings and apparitions. The Magi, we know, best first appear in the Gospel of Matthew, those three wise men, long thought to be Persian astrologers, following a star from the east to find and crown the new king. One need not be a believer to find it a stirring tale of the entanglements of wisdom and revelation, and all the more pleasing for being a little enigmatic. What wise men, what star, what journey? There is something about them to appeal to every imagination, not least in their canny voyage home by another way to evade King Herod's plot. The specifics of the story have long been exploded, of course. Despite many attempts over the centuries to find some historical astronomical occurrence that might correlate with the biblical account, the physicist Aaron Adair has proposed that there was no event in the skies fit for the purpose. No comet, meteor, or supernova to explain it. The star was imagined, made up in part, probably, because of Old Testament prophecies that demanded such a star if a Messiah was to be born at all. A little further reading suggests that the Zoroastrian Persian priestly caste, whom the author of Matthew would have probably known as Magi, were at the time vehemently uninterested in astrology, which they regarded as Roman guff. Indeed, other scholars insist that the Gospel's author did not mean for the Magi to be wise guys at all, or rather only in the strictly Scorsesean sense, as cheaters and scammers whose fake magic was humbled by the real revelation. Matthew's purpose in bringing them onto the scene was to scoff at their obsolescence, not to boast of their endorsement. Yet the ideal of the Magi, the magical visitors, endures. Their vindication continues in the hands of the historian Anthony Grafton, whose new book, Magus, The Art of Magic from Faustus to Agrippa, explores the role of self-styled magicians in the Renaissance. These Magi, who claimed explicit descent from those in the Matthew Gospel, operated for several hundred years on the border between what had long been superstition and what would become science. Magi is the term for wise men, the German Renaissance polymath Johannes Trithemius wrote, adding, "I am not ashamed to be called a Philomagus with them, since I love divine, human, and natural learning. This is my magic, which I follow." Grafton's Magi are an appealing gang, inasmuch as they turn out to have occupied the liminal space between what was faith and what would become fact. The intellectual fabric that their investigations wove, as Grafton entertainingly relays, was an entanglement of absurd system and authentic discovery, of systemic fraud and startling originality, of obvious nonsense and pregnant novelty. We find the medieval Magi diligently advancing astronomy by mapping the skies and the planets, with one desired goal being to predict the planetary conjunctions of Jupiter and Saturn, the so-called Great Conjunction, which they believed marked all the significant turning points in human history. The 13th century English scholar Roger Bacon, Grafton writes, argued that only six great religions could exist, each of them presided over by the conjunction of a planet with Jupiter. Judaism, for example, was the religion of Saturn. If this seems ridiculous, note that the most recent great conjunction was in 2020. Surely as momentous a year as any of those sages could have anticipated. The novelty of Grafton's view is that what makes the Magi matter are not their myths, but their machines. They made things. And it was on the basis of what they made that we got not theoretical science, but technology. It was the shrewd recognition that there was, as they called it, real artificial magic that made the Renaissance Magi our true predecessors. Automatons and astrolabes alike, it seems, were parts of their apparatus. By fudging the barrier, not so much between science and magic, but between artisanal engineering and imaginative speculation, they helped create this world we live in now. They loved to make startling automatons, grasping that any machine that works by means we do not understand looks like magic. And also that all such mechanisms will look like the devil to uneducated eyes. Indeed, one can trace this history of diabolic-seeming machinery from their time through the cascade of new devices leading to our own. A 15th-century wooden devil doll with movable eyes, tongue, horns, arms, and wings gave way to the 18th-century chess-playing Turk, whose very simple machinery no one could understand. Modern magi gave us, in the 19th century, the ominous device of the telegraph. It's surely no accident that Samuel Morse's first telegraph message read, "What hath God wrought?" Radio and TV had their moments of seeming magic, and latest in this line is, of course, the specter of artificial intelligence. Right now, of all these magical machines, AI looks like the one that will, at last, rush us all to hell. Still, many machines have threatened us with that infernal descent in the past, and, as yet, it has not quite occurred. We've seen lots of hells, just not the final one. Everything looks like magic until you know it's a machine. And every machine you don't yet know looks like a deal made with the devil. What all the mythology and history of the Magi suggest is that no bright lines exist to separate fakery from faith or cunning machinery from magical apparatus. There aren't any sharp margins between the irrational and the rational, between what we guess at and what we are sure of, between the wisdom we revere and the fakery we mistrust. We never know exactly who is who or which is which, just as we will never know exactly where we are. The ambiguities of the Magi's apparition remain a lesson in whom to call wise and why to call them so. All knowledge is labile, all identity liminal. Wide-eyed wonder becomes blind faith, just as sharp-eyed skepticism curdles into narrow-minded cynicism. How, then, are we to find our way home? It helps to imagine a star. And now, from the January 1st and 8th, 2024 edition of the New Yorker magazine, the Mongol hordes, they're just like us. Scholars now argue that early nomadic empires were the architects of modernity, but do we have the right measure of their success? By Manveer Singh. In September, Pope Francis became the first leader of the Catholic Church ever to visit Mongolia. It must have been a humbling stopover. The country has fewer than 1,500 Catholics. The welcoming ceremony in Ulaanbaatar's main square attracted a few hundred spectators, a crowd less than 1,000th the size of the one that had gathered to see him in Lisbon a month earlier. One of the attendees had come out to do his morning Tai Chi and unknowingly ended up at the event. Not everyone understood why the pontiff was there. A caterer at a banquet for the Vatican entourage asked a Times reporter, "What are Catholics again?" But the Pope came prepared, speaking to diplomats, cultural leaders, and the Mongolian president. He celebrated the religious freedom protected under the Mongol Empire during the 13th and 14th centuries. The remarkable ability of your ancestors to acknowledge the outstanding qualities of the peoples present in its immense territory and to put those qualities at the service of a common development, the Pope said. He also celebrated, quote, the Pax Mongolica, end quote, the period of Mongol enforced stability across Eurasia, citing its absence of conflicts and respect of international laws. Many early Christians would have been staggered by Francis's words. The first recorded mention of the Mongols in Western Europe is from a Benedictine monk who, in 1240, recorded testimony that the Mongols were an immense horde of that detestable race of Satan, thirsting after and drinking blood and tearing and devouring the flesh of dogs and human beings. 5 years later, Pope Innocent IV sent Gyuk Khan, the third leader of the Mongol Empire, a letter expressing our amazement that the Mongols have invaded many countries belonging to both Christians and to others and are laying them waste in a horrible desolation. Muslims, too, saw the Mongols as bloodthirsty savages. When Hulagu Khan stormed Baghdad in 1258, bodies were heaped on the streets. Drains reportedly ran red in the heart of Muslim civilization, while Baghdad's great library, the House of Wisdom, burned. For many historians, the sacking marked the end of 5 centuries of cultural and scientific flourishing, the Islamic Golden Age. In November 2002, Osama bin Laden claimed that George W.H. Bush's administration had been more destructive than Hulagu of the Mongols. Months later, in the run-up to the Iraq War, Saddam Hussein referred to the United States and its allies as the Mongols of this age. The image of Mongols as brutes outlasted their conquests. In a Voltaire play, they appear as wild sons of rapine who set out to make the splendid seat of empire one vast desert like their own. Today, the name of the empire's founder remains so tied to tyranny and fanaticism that it's become a cliché to describe politicians as somewhere to the right of Genghis Khan. In Russia and Eastern Europe, the Mongol Tatar yoke denotes that not just the period of Mongol rule, but also other forms of despotism. Days after Francis's comments, the Ukrainian political consultant Alexandra Karyabin used the phrase to describe Putin's Russia. But Pope Francis was far from alone in challenging the old tropes. We have too readily accepted the stereotype of supremely violent Mongols who conquered much of Eurasia with stunning ease, Marie Favreau writes in The Horde, How the Mongols Changed the World, published by Harvard. Her work joins other recent volumes, Kenneth W. Harrell's Empires of the Steppes, A History of the Nomadic Tribes Who Shaped Civilizations, published by Hanover Square, Anthony Satin's Nomads, The Wanderers Who Shaped Our World, published by Norton, and Nicholas Morton's The Mongol Storm, Making and Breaking Empires in the Medieval Near East, published by Basic. In a decades-long effort to overhaul narratives about the barbarity of the nomad, and especially Mongols, these works advanced a kind of steppe restoration. Instead of blood-drunk man-beasts, we meet crafty administrators who supported debate, commerce, and religious freedom. Yes, they overran cities, but state formation often demanded it. And yes, they enslaved, but so did lots of societies, and many were much crueler. The steppe restoration typifies what historians call the global turn, a larger project of shifting histories away from nation-states and colonial deformation and toward the peoples and processes that have knotted us together. It's a survey of shadows, a tracing of negative space. It focuses on peoples who, in Satin's words, have long been confined to the anecdotes and afterthoughts of our writers and historians. These are some of the most maligned groups in historical chronicles, the uncivilized, the barbarians at the gate, the tribes who seem to appear from some demonic portal, destroy everything in sight, and then recede back into darkness. The steppe restoration repositions them. It treats them as subjects in their own right, as peoples who have their own histories, who form societies no less complex than the sedentary states they confronted, and who helped craft the world we inhabit. The Eurasian steppe is a vast curtain of grassland that stretches from Hungary to Manchuria. Its size is almost impossible to fathom, a vista of green and tan whose termini are farther from each other than Anchorage is from Miami or Cairo is from Johannesburg. Its historical significance derives from a curious quadruped that has long lived there for roughly 100,000 years, the horse. Long-legged, with powerful lungs, elastic tendons, and a gut capable of digesting tough grass, the creature thrives on the open steppe. Horses were well-equipped to weather the ice age, their hard hoofs able to break through snow and ice to expose grasses underneath. The horse has been the most efficient and enduring means of transport humans have ever used, Satton, a British journalist, writes in Nomads. And the ability to ride a horse transformed life on Earth, perhaps nowhere more so than on the steppe. Horses were bred in captivity on the Western steppe at least 5,000 years ago. The wheel was invented around the same time, and the two innovations combined allowed nomadic pastoralism to flourish. The people of the Yamnaya culture were the first to take advantage of the new technologies and dominate much of the steppe. Starting north of the Black Sea around 3000 BC, they used horses and wheeled carts to traverse astounding distances. Geneticists have found second cousins buried almost 900 miles away from each other. They and their descendants also spilled into Europe, India, the Near East, and Western China, as Harl, a professor emeritus of history at Tulane, recounts at the beginning of Empires of the Steppes. The Yamnaya tongue is one of the earliest offshoots of Proto-Indo-European, and an ancestor of such languages as Greek, German, English, Spanish, Old Celtic, Russian, Persian, Hindi, and Bengali. Today, more than 3 billion people speak an Indo-European language. Roughly 70% of us have some Yamnaya ancestry in our DNA. More than the Greeks, the Romans, or the Chinese, it's the nomadic Yamnaya whose legacy survives in our words and our bodies. In the millennia after the Yamnaya expansion, the makeup of the Eurasian steppe changed. By the 7th century BC, a people known as the Scythians occupied the western end. The Scythians, whose mounted archers wielded composite bows and rode on saddles with leather toe-loop stirrups, controlled much of the steppe lands between the Black and the Caspian Seas. They also helped bring down the Assyrian Empire and, according to Herodotus, twice defeated the king of Persia. Travel to the eastern steppes and jump forward a couple of centuries to around 200 BC, and you find Xiongnu, who for a period collected payment from Han China in exchange for peace. As with so many steppe nomads, much of what we know about the Scythians and the Xiongnu comes from what sedentary people wrote about them. Satin tells us that the name Xiongnu derives from a Chinese word meaning illegitimate offspring of slaves. Harl and Satin combine these accounts with newer genetic and archaeological evidence to construct a richer story. Both the Scythians and the Xiongnu, it turns out, were multi-ethnic confederations. The Xiongnu encompassed a range of tribes across a stretch of steppe about as wide as the continental United States. Under the leadership of a charismatic ruler named Modu Chanyu, they established a complex governing apparatus, complete with Chinese scribes, a bureaucratic hierarchy, and, according to Harl, their own system of writing. In constructing the first imperial order on the steppes, Modu Chanyu wrote the script for subsequent steppe conquerors, from Attila the Hun to Genghis Khan, Harl writes. Among the nomads covered in Empires of the Steppes, Harl is most impressed by Genghis Khan and his Mongols. Attila the Hun helped bring down the Western Roman Empire, while campaigns by the later conqueror, Tamerlane, helped propel the rise of Mughal India, Muscovite Russia, and Shiite Safavid Iran. But the steppe-straddling superpower established by Genghis Khan was uniquely long-lived and expansive. It was through the Mongol Empire, Harl writes, that papermaking, block printing, and gunpowder moved from the east to the west, hastening the spread of knowledge and catalyzing Europe's conquest of the seas. The global economy of the modern age was thus born thanks to the Mongol legacy, he declares. The idea that the Mongols were the architects of modernity is a mainstay of the new scholarship. Satin presents an argument similar to Harl's, adding the compass to the list of innovations sent westward. Although he acknowledges that other nomads, such as the Arabs, helped deliver them to Europeans. Both authors are able to draw upon such earlier work as the anthropologist Jack Weatherford's Genghis Khan and the Making of the Modern World, 2004, a charming, poetic, and laudatory introduction to the Mongols that, more than any other book, helped advance the steppe restoration. All these chroniclers tell a similar story of the Mongols' ascent, a modest, resourceful, and sometimes ruthless hunter nomad named Temujin, having been abandoned by his clan as a 9-year-old, united the tribes of the eastern steppes for the first time in 4 centuries. In 1206, at a gathering of steppe leaders, he was bequeathed the title Chinggis Khan, which means something like fierce or oceanic ruler. The English Genghis Khan comes from translations of Persian sources. In the next 2 decades, he and his followers became the first to bring under one dominion the lands between the Caspian Sea and the Pacific Ocean, an area nearly as wide as the steppe itself. After his death in 1227, Genghis Khan's domain continued to swell until it covered some 20% of the world's landmass from Syria to Korea. In the east, his son, Ogedai, subdued northern China. When Kublai Khan, Genghis's grandson, overtook the south, he unified the country and founded the Yuan dynasty. The events of the west, meanwhile, feature in Morton's The Mongol Storm and Favaro's The Horde. Both books are remarkable scholarly achievements, and the range of sources their authors consult is a testament to Mongol cosmopolitanism. Morton, a historian at Nottingham Trent University, focuses on the realm between the Nile Delta and Anatolia, where Mongols schemed with and against caliphs, crusaders, and Turkish commanders. Favaro, a historian at Paris Nanterre University, tells the story of the Golden Horde, which started in the northwestern sector of the Mongol Empire and, following its breakup, became an autonomous polity that spanned much of Eastern Europe and Central Asia. For Morton, the Mongol invasions were a localized force majeure. Just as an asteroid killed off non-avian dinosaurs and inaugurated the age of mammals, the Mongols set off a firestorm in the eastern Mediterranean that consumed contenders such as the Crusader states, the Abbasid Caliphate, and the Yayubid Empire, creating openings for upstarts including the Mamluks of Egypt and the Ottomans of Asia Minor, both groups themselves descendants of steppe peoples. Favaro prefers a grander framing, as is suggested by her subtitle, How the Mongols Changed the World. The locations and the peoples she lists as examples of this world-changing, however, seem more Warsaw Pact than League of Nations. She returns most often to the Rus, the cultural ancestors of modern Russians, Ukrainians, and Belarusians. The Mongol campaign against the Rus lasted 4 winters, from 1237 to 1241. No more than 50,000 soldiers were sent to conquer a population in the millions. To do so, the Mongols exploited their opponents' weaknesses. The Rus state had become fragmented, beset by quarreling among its princes. By attacking in the cold months, the Mongols surprised the Rus, who didn't expect to go to war that time of year. The Mongols adapted Chinese siege technology to flatten earthen and wooden walls. By the campaign's end, the Mongols controlled some 20 Rus cities. Many, including the old capital, Kiev, had been sacked. Most capitulated within days. A common story of Mongol rule, especially in Russian nationalist scholarship, is a punishing subjugation of an alien people whose yoke strangled development. Favreau argues otherwise. The Russian principalities experienced extraordinary economic vitality during their vassalage to the Horde, she writes, pointing to 40 or more cities built in northeastern Russia in the 14th century. She acknowledges that the Mongols saw the Rus as sources of revenue, but she contends that their strategy was more commercial than repressive. The Mongols connected the Rus, directly or indirectly, to markets in the regions of the Volga River and the Caspian, the Black and the Baltic Seas, along with China, the Middle East, and the Mediterranean. Security and free passage for merchants and goods, privileged treatment for elites, clergy, traders, and artisans, carefully planned tax and land regimes, and mostly indirect governance were the stuff of prosperity for Russian subjects and Mongols alike, she writes. Far from slowing Russia's growth, Mongol policies may have helped bankroll it. The steppe restoration shows the strengths and the limitations of the resplendent new discipline of global history. Often said to have begun around the start of the 21st century, this approach emerged amid the excitement of a commerce-connected, borderless world. In 2005, Thomas Friedman published his treatise of globalization, The World is Flat. The next year, three academics started the Journal of Global History. Writing in the first issue, the British historian Patrick O'Brien declared that global history aimed to leave behind, quote, the arrogance of Rome, end quote, as well as, quote, the scientific and technological triumphalism of the West, end quote. Rather than building stories around the greatness of Europe or of the Caliphate or Confucianism, he advocated for a study of connections and comparisons that would also spotlight the manifold achievements of more peoples, communities, and cultures over long spans of human history. The emerging discipline had to overcome centuries of historiographic hubris. Writing about other peoples has long been in service of self-glorification. Herodotus' histories, penned around 430 BC, covered events on three continents, yet culminated with displays of Greek superiority, celebrating the victories of free Greek city-states over the autocratic barbarian Persians. Chinese dynastic histories, like History of the Han, published in 111 AD, and the New Tang History, published in 1060 AD, endorsed a Sinocentric ideology. Foreign populations were considered civilized to the extent that they adopted Chinese norms. The 9th century Arab scholar Yaqubi started his history of the world with Iraq because it is the center of the world, the navel of the earth, and though he wrote of the great pre-Islamic powers, Persia, Byzantium, and more, it was in order to show how they contributed to the greatest polity of all, the Baghdad-based Abbasid Caliphate. European imperialism shook everything up. As Western powers barged into people's political and psychological worlds, a plethora of ethnocentrisms gave way to Eurocentrism. Histories in Japan, China, India, Africa, and the Middle East were forced to contend with the West's achievements. The preoccupation was most extreme, naturally, in writings by Europeans. In Lectures on the Philosophy of History, published in 1837, Hegel declared that world history travels from east to west, for Europe is absolutely the end of history and Asia the beginning. From 1893 to 1901, the French historians Ernest Lavis and Alfred Rambaud edited a 12-volume history, Historie Générale. Only 10% of its pages were devoted to the non-Western world. More than a century later, the geographical scopes of world histories have expanded. Yet, the West's success remains the grand outcome worth explaining. Ambitious books like Jared Diamond's Guns, Germs, and Steels, 1997, Niall Ferguson's Civilization, the West, and the Rest, 2011, and Darren Acemoglu and James A. Robinson's Why Nations Fail, 2012, all seriously consider non-Western societies, but with the goal of expounding, to quote the title of another popular book by Ian Morris, Why the West Rules, for now. Global history was supposed to transcend all such forms of parochialism, and this goal at first seems realized in the steppe restoration. The nomads, we are told, created cities, enforced peace, and guaranteed religious freedom. They encouraged trade and cultural interaction, recombining ideas, peoples, and technologies with world-shaking consequences. Yet a paradox runs through these books. Steppe peoples are most noteworthy, they seem to assure us, when they look like rich, settled societies. They have a role in world history, insofar as they affect the rise and fall of sedentary, often European, polities. And so the steppe restoration ends up affirming the standards it set out to challenge. Consider how historical significance is determined. Scholars routinely scoff at Hegel's comment that history ended in the West, and yet the steppe restoration shows just how ingrained the notion remains. Favreau and Harl spent years unearthing the stories of steppe peoples. Favreau nevertheless centers her analysis on Europe. Harl ends on it. Satin, in his introduction, caps a list of the ways nomads created the great empires with their contribution to the European Renaissance. In the book's final chapter, he ends a summary of the work by citing the Renaissance and the West's domination and commercialization of the world. Even global histories, it seems, find their epilogues in Europe. And so it goes. Contrary to the claim that the Scythians and the Xiongnu were primitive and isolated, Satin writes, we know from burials that their leaders dressed in Chinese silk robes, trimmed with cheetah fur, sat on Persian carpets, used Roman glass, and had a taste for Greek gold and silver jewelry. Harl similarly assures us that the nomads who conquered Hellenic cities quickly appreciated the high Greek culture they encountered. It's all well meant, but like the historiography of yore, these passages reinforce a hierarchy of civilizations in which the Greeks, the Romans, the Persians, and the Chinese stand at the apex. The way you cease to be barbaric is by trading with these people or embracing their culture, and not through carrying on your own traditions. The new global history has eagerly set out to establish that steppe nomads displayed key features of classic civilizations and liberal democracies, writing, urbanization, and apparently progressive values. But as long as these advances are considered signs of sophistication, nomads will come up short. Harl says that the Xiongnu developed a new script, but unlike the writing of their Han neighbors, no widely accepted remnant survives. Mongols built cities, yet those cities were famously disappointing by sedentary standards. The Franciscan missionary William of Rubruck remarked that the empire's capital, Karakorum, was not as large as the village of Saint-Denis, and the monastery of Saint-Denis is worth 10 times more than that palace. And yes, Genghis Khan permitted some degree of religious freedom, but Mongols, who maintained their shamanistic faith, naturally deemed all other creeds inferior to their own. Global history's professed aim of decentering world history requires a more sophisticated grasp of what sophistication looks like. In the case of nomadic societies, we need to shift our orientation from the static to the flexible. From social complexity embodied in brick and bureaucracies to something that dwells within networks, an ever-responsive capacity for large-scale collective action. What made nomads impressive, after all, is what made them unique. They lived in enormous traveling societies. They subsumed diverse ethnic groups and could mobilize for war almost instantly. They overran the empires at their borders and ruled over them, sometimes for generations. Mongol organization reached its pinnacle in those hordes, self-sufficient mobile units that contained as many as 100,000 people and that transported homes, statues, workshops, palaces, and supply lines. Through settled eyes, we might call these moving cities. Yet the phrase misses their almost aqueous nature, their ability to restructure around births, departures, and political scuffles. Historians have worked to show that, in Satin's words, the nomad story is neither less wonderful nor less significant than our own. But we'll still be treating ourselves as the measure of everything unless we learn to revise our sense of significance. This may be the greatest gift a more global history offers us, greatness redefined. Next, from the December 23rd, 2023 online edition of The New Yorker, when philosophers become therapists, the philosophical counseling movement aims to apply heady logical insights to daily life. Around 5 years ago, David, a pseudonym, realized that he was fighting with his girlfriend all their time. On their first date, he had told her that he hoped to have sex with 1,000 women before he died. They eventually agreed to have an exclusive relationship, but monogamy remained a source of tension. "I always used to tell her how much it bothered me," he recalled. "I was an a-hole." An Israeli man now in his mid-30s, David felt conflicted about other life issues. Did he want kids? How much should he prioritize making money? In his 20s, he tried psychotherapy several times. He would see a therapist for a few months, grow frustrated, stop, and then repeat the cycle. He developed a theory. The therapists he saw wanted to help him become better adjusted given his current worldview. But perhaps his worldview was wrong. He wanted to examine how defensible his values were in the first place. One day, a housemate showed him a book called Philosophy, Humor, and the Human Condition by the French-Israeli philosopher Lydia Amir. Amir, the housemate explained, was his cousin. In addition to teaching part-time at Tufts University, she offered philosophical counseling to private clients. David had never heard of philosophical counseling, but over the next few weeks he read and enjoyed Amir's book. He watched an episode of an Israeli current affairs TV show, London and Kirschenbaum, in which she debated the merits of philosophical counseling with the host. "She actually looked like she enjoyed it when they tried to take her down," David said. He decided to contact her, and they arranged some online sessions. "During the first few meetings, I kind of tested her," David told me. He steered the discussion to abstract ideas from one of his favorite thinkers, the 17th century philosopher Baruch Spinoza. They discussed Spinoza's ethics and his views on God and the infinite. Amir's depth of knowledge impressed him, but she was also quick to acknowledge when he had made insightful points. He started revealing more about his personal dilemmas. David worked with Amir for several years, sometimes meeting a few times each week. Usually, they discussed a personal issue in his life with the aim of posing a philosophical question. Uncertainty about monogamy, for instance, generated the question, "What does freedom mean?" Worries about money led Amir to ask, "What role does wealth play in a good life?" Amir would guide David through multiple philosophical approaches to such questions. "Lydia's smart," he told me. "She just presents you with all kinds of things and lets you see what you connect to. You have a whole bank of knowledge with thousands of years of experience from philosophers." The sessions were a hybrid between therapy and an academic seminar. Between meetings, Amir sometimes gave him reading assignments, Schopenhauer, Nietzsche, Hume. David gradually reconsidered his view of monogamy. "Lydia put me in the mindset of, let's imagine you get what you want. Your wife goes off and has 10 orgasms with a handsome basketball player. How do you feel?" Do I really want polygamy for both of us? Or do I just want absolute freedom for me combined with control over her? After conversations with Amir about Stoicism, Nietzsche, and other philosophers, he understood freedom in a new way. Not as the ability to do whatever he wanted, but as a conscious decision to live in a certain way. You can actually make a choice to limit yourself, he told me. I stopped looking at my wife as someone limiting my freedom. I took responsibility for my choice. While we spoke, David, an intense, dark-eyed man, grew excited. So Nietzsche said something cool, right? He said that everybody searches for power, but the weak search for it everywhere, while the strong will search in very specific places. David applied this insight in his own life by noticing his drive for power and expressing it more selectively. He no longer tried to win every argument or prove that he was right in trivial situations. He and his wife, they married 5 years ago, began fighting less often. Meanwhile, he focused on pursuing power in the financial sphere, shifting from a job in digital marketing to commercial real estate. Amir is one of a small but growing number of philosophers who provide some form of individual counseling. In the United States, two professional associations of philosophical counselors, the National Philosophical Counseling Association, NPCA, and the American Philosophical Practitioners Association, APPA, list dozens of philosophers who can help you with your problems. Italy has multiple professional organizations for different forms of philosophical counseling, and similar organizations exist in Germany, India, Spain, Norway, and several other countries. In Austria, Italy, and Romania, universities offer master's degrees in the field. Everyone should study philosophy, Amir told me. Since few people do, she argues that philosophical counseling fills an important need. If he changed, it's because he got educated, she said of David's transformation. And he got educated because he wanted a philosophical education. If something good happened to him, it happened because of philosophy, not me. I just enabled the encounter. Amir was born in Paris in 1955, the daughter of a Jewish Holocaust survivor. When she was an infant, the family moved to Israel. Her father, a diplomat, traveled frequently for work, and her childhood was spent in Israel, France, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Algeria, and Senegal. Her mother was a political journalist, and their houses were full of books. When she was 17, she found a volume of Plato and became captivated by the dialogues. She initially studied math and philosophy as an undergraduate at the University of Tel Aviv, but much of her interest in math was philosophical. What's natural about the natural number series? She decided to focus solely on philosophy, eventually writing a dissertation on concepts of personal redemption in Spinoza and Nietzsche. Amir's doctoral advisor encouraged her to supplement her theoretical analysis with concrete personal examples, and she recognized two major things in her life that she wanted to change. First, she wanted to quit smoking. Though she was writing about personal freedom, she often felt controlled by the pleasure of cigarettes. Most of the advice that she read involved reducing temptation. The idea was to spend less time around other smokers and to get rid of cigarettes and ashtrays. Amir did the opposite, carrying cigarettes with her everywhere. I wanted it to be a free choice at every moment, she recalled. The question was, what kind of vision of yourself do you want to have? Amir was also afraid of flying. She's still afraid, travels frequently, and swears that each flight will be her last. I've accepted that I feel as if I'm going to die before every flight. I don't try to fight that feeling, she told me. When she finished her PhD, she hadn't flown in a decade. She concluded, philosophically, that death was preferable to a life in which her freedom was limited by fear, and flew to Paris despite her anxiety. It seemed unacceptable to her to study philosophical ideas of freedom, but not to live by them. I decided that anything is better than to live like that, she said. In the late 1980s and early 90s, Amir taught philosophy at various universities in Tel Aviv and lectured in a continuing education program for adults. Some of her adult students wanted to talk to her about their personal issues, and she gave them her phone number. They started referring friends. A journalist covered her work, which brought more clients. As more strangers began asking for time, she started charging for private sessions on a sliding scale. Her current rate is around $150 an hour. Philosophy is both a natural and a strange resource for helping people resolve the problems of life. Ancient philosophical traditions, such as Stoicism and Buddhism, focused on practical ethics and techniques for alleviating suffering, but much modern philosophy seems to aim to express suffering rather than reduce it. Life is deeply steeped in suffering, Schopenhauer wrote. At bottom, its course is always tragic, and its end is even more so. My view is that it's about thinking, Amir said, of her counseling work. It's not developing skills of listening and being empathic, which philosophers are not especially trained to do. It's personal tutoring in philosophy. There is, she claims, no other discipline that teaches you how to think better when it relates to your life. To really understand philosophical counseling, Amir suggested, I would need to try a session. As it happened, she'd soon be attending an international conference on philosophical counseling in Romania. We met in the high-ceilinged atrium of the Romanian Academy near the city's historic downtown. More than 50 philosophers from a dozen countries had gathered, and the conference felt like the reunion of a large and eccentric family. Amir spotted me from across the room, but was intercepted by Spanish, Romanian, and American colleagues before she reached me. I asked about her flight. Ah, you remembered, she said, smiling. Not good, but I'm here. We made our way into a small auditorium where Amir would be giving the conference's keynote address. Her goal, she told me, was to get people excited. Pacing before the lectern with the microphone, she threw some shade on traditional psychotherapists. They cannot offer you ideals. They cannot offer you a worldview, she said. She suggested that philosophy alone was capable of sparking transformation by exposing people to many viewpoints and increasing their capacity to assess them rationally. The crowd seemed delighted. That afternoon, we sat at a table at a restaurant beside the Vega River for an individual session. Amir pushed her long, blonde hair away from her eyes, took a sip of tea, and asked me what I wanted to discuss. For the past few years, I said, I've been working on a book. Now I was waiting for it to be published, and its fate was mostly out of my hands. I'd also known that its success would be judged partly by its sales. As publications loomed, this fact troubled me more and more. I felt almost queasy when I thought about it. Your first book will be published soon, which is wonderful, Amir said. Its success may be evaluated based on the sales, which is ridiculous. If it doesn't sell well, this does not mean it's not good. But it's an element you cannot control. Yes, I said, that's about it. She took a sip of tea. So, what is so maddening about not controlling something? I thought for a bit. Well, if you perceive that other things you care about depend on what you can't control, that can be maddening. Yeah, Amir said, but isn't it usually like that? Like what? With everything. You cannot control that a flight will go right. Then you can lose your life, your leg, your luggage, your wife. Usually the things we cannot control are not just small things. She swept one hand through the air, as if to apply the point to the rowers and sculls slicing through the brown river, and to the people in cars buzzing across a bridge overhead. Now, we have your notion of the uncontrollable. That is something to explore. We have your perception of success. Third would be the relationship between success and the thing that is not controllable. For a while, we discussed different definitions of success. Then she turned the conversation to Spinoza. He says that the person who wants to live without fear needs to live without hope. Most people want to have just the bright side of things without the dark side. But it's the same coin, she said, her eyes narrowing. Gaining peace of mind, she suggested, would come at a price. If I achieved detachment, I wouldn't care if the book sold well. We were near the end of our hour. My first book was sold out 8 months after it was published, Amir said. It's an academic work, but after that I had multiple contracts for future books. I lost something. I became chained to my writing desk. You may think success just means more possibilities, but once one possibility is realized, many other things are no longer possible. You may look back on these months as a time of freedom. If I were to undertake more sessions, she said, we would go deeper into these ideas. I might read from Seneca and Epictetus. There was no moment of shattering insight during the session, but afterward I felt a pleasant broadening of perspective. On my second day in Romania, I observed a philosophical counseling session between Adam Lalak, a 30-year-old man from Prague, and Lou Marinoff, a 72-year-old professor of philosophy at the City College of New York and a co-founder of APPA. Lalak had finished a master's degree in philosophy at Cambridge and then held various private sector and nonprofit jobs. He was now aspiring to become a philosophical counselor. Lalak and Marinoff sat facing each other in an empty conference room. Pale sunlight spilled through a high window onto the wood table between them. So I turned 30 about a month ago, Lalak began, stroking his dense blonde beard, and it feels like I have been pulled into two very opposing directions. I'm feeling like this age is bringing a lot of responsibility, like I'm supposed to be grown up and get a job and family. And I'm feeling like I really want to cut all the BS. I want to get to the things which I find very important, which is, for example, philosophy. And philosophy is not very practical. Marinoff, who had a salt-and-pepper beard and mobile, bushy eyebrows, held a pen and jotted notes as Lalak spoke. So this is partly a clash of values, he said. He asked Lalak about his girlfriend, his parents, his past jobs, and future prospects. The crux of Lalak's dilemma was that he wanted to do something interesting and make a decent living. Both might be possible, but getting a doctorate in philosophy and hoping for the best was financially risky. Have you had any encounters with Asian philosophy? Marinoff asked. I like to read the Tao Te Ching, but I haven't really studied it, Lalak said. Marinoff wrote in his notebook. Wonderful, wonderful, he said. I've been with that book for 50 years. It's been a great guide to me, personally, and the I Ching even more so. I'm going to sort of prescribe something that you could read that may help resolve this tension. The first part of Marinoff's prescription was Sartre's essay, Existentialism is a Humanism, which Marinoff suggested could be a useful aid in recognizing whether one is acting authentically. The second was the I Ching, an ancient Chinese divination manual. There's a website that allows users to consult it online, Marinoff said. So what happens is you get a hexagram by random means. You'll reach a phrase or a line or a sentence or two, and it will jump off the page and speak to you. And it will tell you what's in your heart and your mind. It's reflecting back to you the advice that you need to give yourself in order to take the better way forward. Lalak frowned and wrote something in his own notebook. He was mostly quiet as Marinoff reminisced about his youth spent doing unspeakable things with electric guitars and motorcycles and recommended meditation over psychedelics. I couldn't decide whether Marinoff reminded me of an eccentric grandfather advising a young relative or a professor oversharing during office hours. After the session, Lalak seemed politely underwhelmed. The prescriptions didn't feel that tailored to me, he told me. It was more like they were just his favorite books. I wonder if he'd assigned the same things if I had had different issues. Later in the conference, he planned to have a session with an expert on existentialism and another focused on Socratic dialogue. It's not very formalized, he said. There are no real methods. During my time in Romania, I heard philosophical counselors champion meditation, psychedelics, wine, and knitting, along with ideas from thinkers such as Foucault, Marx, and Aristotle, who themselves would agree on very little. Counselors certified by APPA use everything from guided meditations to targeted explorations of existentialist, Kantian, and Stoic philosophy. The National Philosophical Counseling Association, by contrast, emphasizes a method called logic-based therapy. Both organizations require members to have a master's or a doctorate in philosophy in order to become certified practitioners. Some think that the practice of philosophical counseling should be more standardized. Others worry that philosopher counselors will miss serious mental health issues. The two major American professional associations stress that philosophical counseling can't address certain severe psychiatric disorders and urge counselors to refer clients to mental health providers when their issues do not fit a philosophical scope of practice. Angie Hobbs, a professor of philosophy at the University of Sheffield, who doesn't do philosophical counseling, told me that she worries about whether philosophers will know when to make referrals. Lynn Bufka, a clinical psychologist in Maryland who works for the American Psychological Association, said that as a psychologist with a doctorate, she had needed about 4,000 hours of supervised training before she could apply for a psychological counseling license. These days, to get the certification without ongoing supervised experience would be very concerning for me, she said, referring to the length of training required by APPA. On the other hand, some philosophical counselors frame their work as aimed at resisting the creeping medicalization of life. Living involves many doubts, anxieties, and confusions, and not every perplexity is a pathology. For any human quandary, there's likely a philosopher who has wrestled with it in the past few millennia. Their insights may not confer the sorts of benefits that randomized clinical trials can study, but they're potentially profound. On the last day of the conference, I met Amir for a late lunch. She wanted to convince me that, despite its heterogeneity, philosophical counseling did have a basic essence. All sorts of interventions, from psychedelics to meditation and fortune-telling, had the potential to help someone. But philosophy was different because it addressed deep human questions about ethics, purpose, and meaning with logical precision. It was an underused resource. Just look at a bookstore, she said. You have shelf after shelf of self-help books, and then philosophy will be in some corner where no one goes. After lunch, I thought of Wittgenstein. His work on the logical foundations of mathematics can seem impossibly distant from daily life, yet his aim in doing philosophy, he wrote, was to show the fly the way out of the fly bottle. We've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it, and we'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The New York readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.